Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the New Med Group, hosted here at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people doing good things, creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch, two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us an individual fairly new to our community, the leader of the largest employer in our region, and provider of a critical service to all of us. The New Med Group would like to extend a special thanks to the Cheeseman Center for Sound, the Stock Growers Association for the chairs you're sitting in, or some of you are, Scott Sumner with Sumner Law for brewing coffee. We want to thank the members of the Garage for letting us use your office space, the Bush Foundation, and for everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. Please join us on Facebook, engage in our conversation at hashtag MorningPhilip. Now, with all that, please join me in welcoming Regional Health President and CEO, Brent Phillip. Thanks for joining us last night at dinner. We had a really nice dinner over at Delmonico Grill. And join us this morning, and we've got some other meetings yet this morning, but thank you for taking all this time with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So if we just jump right in, and one of the interesting things I think as a leader, one of the interesting things I think as a community member in this in Rapid City is to learn more about the leadership. And on that note, I'd just like to ask you, what do you think the most important characteristic of a leader is?
Matt said he was going to start with a softball question. I think a leader has to listen. A leader has to inspire. I think those are the two most important things. Being new to regional health and new to the Black Hills and Rapid City, listening has been critically important to get to know the community and get to know the organization and our needs, our strengths and our weaknesses. And we have both. But I think it's critically important that a leader actually inspires people to strive for something greater than what we are today. I think that's the first characteristic of leadership. We have to inspire. We have to challenge ourselves and challenge the people that we work with and work around to be something greater than we are today. And the second is we have to be able to provide the resources so that vision and that dream can be realized. Because without that, it's just that, it's just a dream. And the third is that of accountability. We have to be accountable as leaders, and we have to hold our organizations or our community, whatever our responsibility is, we have to hold ourselves accountable for the proper use of those resources.
When you think back on your career, do you have a mentor that has inspired you?
I actually have several mentors. I don't have a single mentor throughout my entire career, but I have mentors in particular moments throughout my life. I had the opportunity when I was 19 years old to serve as a missionary in Zimbabwe, and I remember a situation where a mother in a small village explained to me why her kids were not all in school, and it's because she couldn't afford the $2 for the school uniform for all her kids to go to school at the same time. And so half her kids went to school on Monday and came home and taught the others what they learned, and then on Tuesday the other kids put on the uniform, blue shorts and a blue shirt, and they went to school, and they came home and taught their siblings. And what she taught me was the importance of a positive attitude, because she, in fact, had a positive attitude. Now, as a 19-year-old, that seemed like the greatest injustice I had ever heard, that kids couldn't go to school because of a $2 uniform. And she had a positive attitude because it was more than she had as she grew up. And it struck me that we absolutely control our attitude. I have opportunities to meet with all of our new caregivers that join Regional Health every other Monday during orientation, and I challenge them to control their attitude. And we oftentimes we delegate our attitude to things. You know, tomorrow morning when we wake up and there's snow on the ground, some of us are going to delegate our attitude to the weather. And we're going to say it's going to be a lousy day because there's snow on the ground. Or there's road construction or whatever it might be. And I think taking control of our attitude is critical. So she taught me that. growing up, Genghis Khan, believe it or not, was a mentor of mine in the way that he motivated 250,000 men to ride across Asia, knowing that they had no way back if they didn't win. I mean, think about the inspiration that he had to be able to instill in those men to do that. Our youngest son, Russell, is the calmest person I know. He's now a missionary in Kentucky, but going through high school and the whirlwind of high school, he is a very calm person and weathered that extremely well. So I have lots of different mentors. They each teach me different things.
Thank you for sharing. Now, would you take a few minutes? I'm hoping that you share a little bit about your leadership style, what you hope people see, like you just described.
I think hope is the operative word. What we hope they see. I would describe my style as, it's maybe complex. I'm direct and I'm honest, but I'm also transparent and compassionate. And so it's rather complex. I'm undeviating when it comes to excellence and driving for excellence in everything we do. We need to strive to be the best in everything we do. We're not going to be perfect, but we need to be the best we can be. And if we're not, we need to recommit on our way home from work to say, tomorrow I'm going to do better. But in the business that we're in healthcare, and many of us are in the social sector in one way or another, compassion is a critical element to that. We have the opportunity within healthcare to take care of people when they are the most vulnerable. If you think about healthcare, and we've all been patients, we don't go to the hospital or to the doctor because we want to. We go because we need to, and we're generally in pain or we're suffering or we're depressed, we're anxious, we're nervous, we're all of these things. And it's critically important that we as leaders and we as caregivers and physicians are compassionate and caring, because the public turns over their trust to us in a matter of a few minutes, and it's a huge responsibility to take that trust and then care for those people.
You joined Regional Health and the Rapid City community about 15 months ago. There have been numerous changes at the health system, changes which you talked about on Friday at the Press Club event. On Saturday, the journal's headline was Regional Health Leader, Some employees not devoted to being number one are gone. I'm wondering if you would like to talk about that today.
Sure.
Questions just get easier.
Yeah, I see that. Nolan Ryan is pitching currently, if anybody wondered. So I ask you, are we happy with the status quo of healthcare in the Black Hills? If we're not satisfied with the status quo, what would we be satisfied with? Now, when I got here, working with the board, we established a vision that we aspire to be the best health system in America. The best. Why not? I would say that we in the Black Hills deserve the best health care possible. It sounds a lot better than we aspire to be the 30th percentile. Those t-shirts don't sell well in the gift shop. We aspire to be the best. And so just like, and I use this example at the Press Club, just like a football team, if the football team is 3-12 and they bring in a new coach, is the new coach going to stay if they aspire to be 3-12 again? No. New leadership gets brought in, coach, CEO, to change the direction. And I don't believe that status quo is acceptable. I believe that we do need to aspire to be the best. And the model that we've used is we establish that is our vision. We aspire to be the best health system in America. And what that means is none of us get to opt out. None of us. Because to be the best, everyone has to do their best. If you say you want to be 50th percentile, half the people can say, I think I'm going to take a pass today because we're only striving to be 50th percentile. Right? So Matt's going to do really well today. I can take a pass. That'll be 50th percentile. But if you say we want to be the best, no one gets to opt out. Everyone has to bring their A game every day. Now, are we perfect? No. Do we strive to be the best? Absolutely. We've had leadership development coaches working with our executive team since probably the third month I was here. Why? Because we get better when we have coaching. Phil Jackson spent more time with Michael Jordan than he did the number 12 guy on the bench. Right? You invest leadership coaching in your best talent. And so every one of our leaders has had an executive coach to help us develop the skills needed so we can, in fact, transform the organization to be the best. Not everyone agrees with that. Some people chose to opt out of that and say, I don't agree with that. I think status quo was fine. That's too difficult. Whatever it might be. And those people are no longer with us. I don't apologize for it. I believe we deserve to have the best healthcare in the Black Hills.
So interesting that you brought Phil Jackson up, because while you were talking and you referenced 3-12, I started thinking of, so Phil Jackson brought the triangle offense around Michael Jordan to the Bulls, and he created that, and it was easy to measure what success was because of the wins and losses and all the other data. What is the data that we're going to be able to look at in, I don't know, how many you pick, 3 years, 5 years, that we're going to say that we reached this best?
I'm glad you didn't ask me a basketball question, because if you haven't noticed, I'm really not built like a basketball player.
We're going to talk about Green Bay Packers.
There you go. I think the measurement is actually very easy.
Okay.
It starts with patient and family experience. It begins with creating a culture of safety and quality. And I'll give you a great example of one of the things that's happened in the last 15 months that is tremendous and impacts every single one of us. Sepsis is a leading cause of death in America's hospitals. America's hospitals. There's about 6,000 hospitals in America. Sepsis is infection in the blood. Everyone in this room could have the same bacteria, the same infection in your blood, and only a fraction of us actually develop sepsis. Sepsis is, the mortality rate, the death rate is 40%. In the hospital. So if you're in the hospital and you develop sepsis, or you have sepsis and you're admitted to the hospital, the chance that you will die is 40%. For every hour that you are not properly diagnosed and treatment begins, your chance of dying increases by 5%. So if you have sepsis and it's not properly diagnosed and treatment begins within 1 day, you mathematicians in the room can figure out it's not a good outlook for you. And if you survive, organ failure or brain damage is generally what happens. Okay. We had a group of physicians and nurses from across the organization come together and say, we want to do better in this area of treating sepsis. They developed a protocol. So when every single patient that enters the hospital, they are screened for sepsis. It's a very easy screen, but it has to be done 100% of the time. So the results, last fall, we looked at the results from 2015, and our mortality rate was 17%, less than half of the national average. We had a professor from Mayo Clinic that came and visited, gave grand rounds on Friday morning. We'll have a guest lecturer come in from somewhere across the United States and speak about innovative things going on within healthcare. And he spoke about sepsis. He's a medical director for sepsis at Mayo Clinic. And then he toured the unit, talked to the doctors, talked to the nurses, and learned about what we were doing, went home, and about 2 weeks later he called and said, can you send me your protocol that you follow? It's better than what we are doing at Mayo Clinic. And so as we aspire to be the best health system in America, you take it one piece at a time. So we are here today. We aspire to be here. And we continue to move forward. Sepsis, I would say we are best in class, up there with the very best. And we continue to refine it. We continue to get better. Other things, we're here. Other things, we're here. And we continue to move things towards that. Another important after safety and quality is our caregiver and physician engagement. It's interesting, engagement was what we started with. That was one of our priorities. But engagement, when you think about the term, it's an important term. Are we engaged in our community? Are we engaged with the company we work with? But engagement is very me-focused. Am I engaged? Right? So this year we changed it to caregiver and physician empowerment. Empowerment is much more outward focused. It's what am I doing to make the community, our organization, my team, what am I doing for them? What am I doing to serve others? And so Paulette Davidson and I, she's our chief operating officer, joined us in November. Again, another team member, Kim, came from Nebraska Medicine. We had 32 town hall meetings across the Black Hills, meeting with hundreds and hundreds of caregivers and physicians. And we talked about our progress to date and where we continue to head in the future. And we talked about empowerment, that everyone within healthcare has a very prescribed job. You know, we talk about thinking outside the box. The reality is we need healthcare workers to think in the box. I don't need nurses computer programming. I don't need computer programmers trying to be doctors, right? We all have a very prescribed technical job that we are responsible for. But from the service perspective, we can all think this broad. And we can solve problems for our colleagues, for our team, for our patients, and for our community. And so that's what empowerment is. And we challenged all 5,000 to push the envelope on empowerment, to look for ways to solve patient and family problems, to make the experience better. And it's great as I get letters that come in from caregivers, emails and texts that say, this is what I did. And there, some of them are very simple. I'll give you two quick examples. Was at the Massaberry Clinic, and when I asked the question, does anyone have an example of when you empowered yourself to go above and beyond? And one of the front desk staff at the clinic said, we had a patient that came in to see us and had both knees replaced, and he couldn't walk very well. And it was this last winter, and it was icy and snowy, like tonight. And I was worried that he would not be able to get out to the mailbox to get the paperwork that we mailed to him that he needed to then mail back. And so on my way home, I went out of my way, went to his house, took him the papers, he signed them, and I brought him back to the clinic the next day. A very simple thing, but what impact it had on that person. We had another situation where we had a rancher from Wyoming flown in by helicopter to Rapid City Regional Hospital, and then when he was discharged, he had no way to get home because he flew here by helicopter. And he was talking to the nurse that was caring for him and said, I don't have a way to get home, and I don't really have any friends and family. I'm sort of, you know, just a rancher in the middle of Wyoming, and I am sort of on my own. And so this nurse said, why don't you give me directions to your home, and my son and I will drive there. It was a four-hour drive. They drove there and brought his pickup back to him. Now, those are great stories. And we encourage our caregivers to tell those stories because socializing those stories makes it more the norm instead of the exception.
thanks for sharing those examples. We've got a few other questions along that line, but before we move into that, I want to just go back to the article from Saturday. There was a lot about change that was written, and I just have a question. What is the most difficult decision you've had to make in the last 14 months or so, 15 months, change that you drove?
I think the most difficult decision has been deciding on the pace of change. That's probably been the most difficult. For some, it's not fast enough. And for many, it's too fast. And then you balance that with the needs of the community and the needs of the patient. And that's really what governs the pace of change. And it puts a strain on the organization and our caregivers, because no one likes change. I know people sometimes say they like change. I don't really buy that. I think change is difficult. Even when change is positive, it is difficult. I personally, we're renting a home. We're currently building. We're going to move in 3 weeks or 4 weeks when it finishes. I'm excited to move into the new home. I really am. But it's change. I have to pack up and move. That's painful, right? So in 3 months, ask me if it was fantastic. It was. But the journey of change is difficult, right? I don't know of very many moms, my experience is rather limited, who are excited to have a second child or third or fourth in the middle of labor, right? Change is difficult, right? Now, when it's all over, right, and you give it time, excited to maybe think about having another child. So the essence of change is difficult. And so our pace, trying to govern what we can handle as an organization, what we as individuals can handle, and then the pace that is required, I believe, from the community. Balancing all of that has been probably the biggest challenge.
So how do you do that? I wonder if you're willing to talk about that issue of balance that you, Regional Health, has in the community, that Regional and the way that Regional Health is approaching some of these important issues and change. How do you ensure the community, this approach, respects the diversity of the community and the history? How do you find that balance for yourself and for the health system?
That was a big question. The diversity of our community can be, there's lots of ways diversity can be defined. Maybe the most obvious is the American Indian community, the non-Native American Indian community, and the dynamics between the two. That is actually the reason that I took this job, because at this point in my career, I was looking for where can I go to have the greatest impact on the most people. And I believe we have significant needs. I think all of us recognize that. But what we lack are clear solutions to move from where we are, status quo, to a better place. And I don't have all those answers. I have a few, but I look for opportunities to partner and work with other people to, in fact, find those solutions. I've had opportunities to work for three fantastic organizations throughout my career. None of those organizations were as large a part of a community as Regional Health is to the Black Hills. And I think there's a social responsibility that Regional Health has within this community that goes beyond just delivering healthcare. I think given our size, we have to play a role in economic development, in improving education, in decreasing homelessness, in looking at workforce development, child care. I mean, all of those social issues that face us as a community, I believe we have to play a role in that. That's unique for me in my 25 years of healthcare experience. No other community did I live in that you played a role in those areas. But regional health certainly can't do it alone. We look for partners to help, and those partners are coming together, and exciting things are happening. I'm very, very encouraged by it. We have to recognize and acknowledge the rich heritage that we have, not only Native American, but also our rancher, Western South Dakota, cowboy roots, and how we capitalize on those, the rich heritage and the strengths of each of those to do something better. And I don't think we fully realize the strengths of each of those elements of our economy or our culture to drive forward in an organized fashion. For me, I had to start with educating myself. I had an opportunity to participate, thanks to Karen and the Bush Foundation, for Lakota Lands and Identity Tour, which brought 40 community leaders together to learn about the Lakota lands and the identity of the Lakota people. And we had a bus tour for 5 days and saw sacred sites and learned about the culture and the history. And it was a fantastic experience. It was a rich experience, life-changing. And then we had the opportunity to then do that within regional health and invite caregivers from Rosebud Hospital and Pine Ridge Hospital and Sioux San Hospital and the Community Health Center and bring together a group of healthcare workers and do the same thing so we can come together and build bridges across healthcare, which is a first important step. Regional health serves as the safety net for the community at large. There really is, we don't have a county hospital within Pennington County. So Rapid City Regional Hospital, by default, serves in that role. It's a challenge serving in that role, I'll be honest with you, because there is no city and county support of the, quote, county hospital like you would see in a normal community. In a normal community, there would be a tax levy that would probably be $40 million that would go to support the county hospital, who takes care of all the indigent in a community. We don't have that in Rapid City or Pennington County or in any of the Black Hills. Regional health as an organization is not for profit. Last year, our revenue after we paid all of our expenses was $16 million. We're not for profit, which means we don't have shareholders, we don't have dividends. That money stays within the organization and is then used to pay for new facilities, recruit physicians, give pay increases to our nurses, which we gave $5 million last year and another $3 million this year. That's the way that money is used. But to counter the $16 million that was earned, we provided $70 million in uncompensated care last year. $70 million. That's not a business model that's sustainable. So we have to, as a community, as a state, as a nation, resolve issues like Medicaid expansion, like Indian Health Services, like mental health services. You know, the state has a hospital in Yankton. That's about as far away as you can get from us. And so we don't benefit in Western South Dakota by the state facility that's in Yankton. Those patients become our patients, which we care for, but there's no reimbursement for it. And so my concern, given our status as the healthcare provider, really, in the Black Hills region, is we need to make sure that we are here tomorrow to provide that care and those services that we so desperately need. I think healthcare drives economic development. If we did not have healthcare, how many of us would have come to work here or would stay here? We wouldn't. We can't grow business without good healthcare. It's integral. Likewise, we can't recruit healthcare physicians and nurses who can work anywhere in the world or in the United States if we don't have good housing, affordable housing, if we don't have good education. That's a whole other topic. If you want to throw that one,
we can talk. I don't know if we're going to have time, but a couple things to follow up on. The idea that, and this actually comes from a question that we received by email, that does this region need another hospital?
If they want to take part of the $70 million of uninsured care, absolutely. If they want to come in and not provide assistance and care for the uncompensated, then I would say no. It absolutely puts at risk our healthcare system as a whole. I know the CEOs of Sanford Navarro very well. This is a very difficult market. Our business portfolio, if you will, just terms that we may be all familiar with, when you look at Medicare patients, Medicaid patients, the VA, Indian Health Services, active military, and then people that don't have insurance, none of those patients, and that's 75% of our business, none of those patients actually cover the cost of their health care. So if cost is $100, every single one of those, the reimbursement to regional health is less than $100. It's not even a break-even proposition. So if you are a business owner or you run a business and you have health care coverage for your own employees, you know how the costs have continued to go up. Well, one of the reasons they continue to go up at the rate they go up is because you're in the 25%, and those rates go up higher to cover the losses on the 75, so we can stay afloat. And so it's one of the reasons economic development is so critical to our region, because the burden on the 25% will be significantly less if we had another, imagine, 10,000 workers in Rapid City that were insured, 20,000. All of a sudden that burden becomes much less. We dilute that burden. We have to find better models in partnership with the federal government. We're actively doing it. It is a challenge to find ways, working with tribal leaders and IHS, to find better ways to deliver health care on the reservation and in Rapid City. All of those things are very complicated. I think it'll be difficult for another hospital to come to town when you look at that portfolio. Now, will a hospital come to town and say, we're really not interested in the 75%, we really want to target the 25%? Well, and that could happen. What it does, it jeopardizes the overall system because you just can't keep it afloat.
Can we go back to, I'm curious, you mentioned the tour that you did, the 5 days on a bus. Is there something that jumps to mind along the lines of enriching and life-giving, as you mentioned, that you'd be willing to share with everybody?
You know, the actual sites that we visited, they each had a unique spirit to them and a feeling that were unique to each of the sites. But I think probably the most impressive thing for me was getting to know people that were on the bus and developing relationships and friendships with people that I probably would not have run into in my daily life. Bruce Longfox is a good example. Bruce Longfox, if you don't know him, leads Rural America Initiative. Rural America Initiative is a program that is funded by federal grants. They have 243 kids in a Head Start, early Head Start program. 243, all are under the poverty line. All. So you think about getting kids ready for school, and who are our most vulnerable kids? They're kids that are under the poverty line, and he has 243. He employs over 100 Native Americans. You have to be drug and alcohol free. I mean, it's a fantastic service that he provides. I would not have met Bruce. He has an Atiapi program, which is a mentoring program for middle school and high school kids that do not have fathers in the home, and has over 800 kids in that mentoring program. Their high school graduation rate of kids in that program is almost double kids that are not in that program. I mean, tremendous. And that's just one individual. We had 40 mm-hmm. on the bus. Mm-hmm. It was very rich.
What do you enjoy most about your job?
Well, things like this, without a doubt. I mean, that's an easy one. Give me another easy one. No, you know, you want me to be serious, right? Okay. I now I'm going to sort of counter what I said earlier. I'd enjoy change. I don't really like the journey so much, but I really like inspiring better and driving towards excellence and then giving people the opportunity after this very difficult journey to then turn and look back and say, look where we've come from. Look what we've accomplished. Imagine the sepsis team when they come together at the end of the year and you say, there's 100 people that are alive today because of the work you did. 100. I mean, just think about all of your family and all of your friends, and it may not equal 100. Now imagine if they were all not here. The hole that leaves, 100 people. And so that ability, I mean, I'm in the best industry possible because we have opportunities to affect lives. Now, the risk is you have a responsibility to impact lives. And so, much like education, when it works well and you do it right, it's incredibly rewarding. And when you don't, it's very disappointing because we are dealing with people's lives.
When you think of the last 15 months in Rapid City, what's the most surprising? What's most surprising to you?
Besides the weather?
Besides the weather.
I'm trying to bring a little humor in here, Matt.
I'm not very funny.
I got a joke. I'm waiting for the time to slip it in.
I can do a knock-knock.
I think the most surprising is our lack of an organized effort to drive our economy, to improve our education, to improve our health care. It seems that we are too comfortable with status quo as a community. Now, clearly, I would say that is not a statement that I would make about this group. You got up at 7 in the morning, or you're here at 7, you got up earlier, and you're here because you want to be part of change, and you are currently impacting change, and you're part of that in your community. But there's 75,000 people who aren't here today, and a portion of them are very comfortable with where we are today and are very happy with where we are today. That's a disappointment. That's a disappointment. When I hear stats like 600 and 700 kids in school are homeless, classified as homeless, that is a problem. I don't see how anyone can listen to statistics like that and say, that's okay. But what are we doing? What are we doing to change that? Where is the group of men and women who are saying, let's get serious about economic development? And I know there's efforts that are going on, but really in a concerted way, what are we doing to bring 10,000 new jobs? I get excited too when Panera Bread comes, but for that to make top of the fold news of our paper is a bit of an embarrassment. And that is not economic development. You know, where is the group saying, let's bring 10,000 jobs to the community?
So along those lines, what do you think the biggest hurdle is to that?
I think as a community, we're a layered community. There's a group of us that are very comfortable with where we are because we're rather successful and we're comfortable. There's another large segment of our community that is silent, and they're in need, and they may not know how to actually affect change. And I think these communities have got to come together more, because ultimately we will improve as a community by all of us improving. So I would say to our community the haves, I would say, just like I said to our own caregivers, it's less about engagement and your own happiness. It's equally important for us to be empowered to make change and improve for all. So instead of thinking all about ourselves, how do we think about us in a collective? And that's difficult to do. But I think that is what is critical. I don't believe we as a community will move forward if we have 30,000 people that have needs of some kind. We've got to find ways to remedy those needs and present opportunities for people to find hope. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges. There's a segment, a growing segment of, and it's not just Rapid City, it's our economy nationwide, where there is a lack of hope. The gentleman or the woman who drops out of high school that is now 25, that's never been employed, how much hope do they have about their future? Think about it. It's very difficult to find hope when you're in that situation. When you've never been employed, you may live a life of crime. I mean, where is hope? There's not much. I think as a business community, for-profit and not-for-profit, we have got to find ways to engage with the whole community to find ways to help.
As the largest employer, the economic impact of the organization is significant. The organization is a nonprofit. You talked a little bit about this before. How does being a nonprofit influence how you do the work? Take away the $70 million or the $45 million in 2014 and what's charity care and not and all that. Take that away. Separate that piece because all hospitals do some of that or do a significant amount of that. Mm-hmm. How do the decisions that are made at Regional Health as a non, because it's a nonprofit versus a for-profit?
So the not-profit status, not-for-profit status has an impact in the way we set our strategic goals. Maybe slightly different than a for-profit would. But the execution of those goals, I would argue, is exactly the same in a for-profit and a not-for-profit. I mean, it is a business with 5,000 people. We have to be efficient. We have to look for economies of scale. We need our employees to work just as hard and be high-performing and be excellent in what they do, just like any other business. In fact, some days I would argue it's more difficult running a not-for-profit because we don't have the ability to raise our rates when things happen. You know, when I get the statement from the guy that cuts my lawn in my rental and he says, oh, and if fuel prices go up, we get to add a surcharge. I'm like, I don't get to do that. Right? The federal government, 75% of my business says, here's your rate, oh, by the way, and it's below what your cost is. Have a good day. And so it's a very different business model. And so it requires us to be even more exact in our decisions. And that's why timeliness and change is critically important now. We have to maximize. We have to look at use of energy. I mean, we hired a new individual, Wes Paxton, who's in charge of all of our facilities and construction. And him and his team, he pulled his team together and he talked about empowerment and says, I want you to find ways that we can save money. And within a couple months, there was an idea that we can capture steam out of the smokestack. And it's 1 million gallons of water, city water, 1 million gallons of water a year that's recaptured and reused. 1 million gallons. Now it saves $50,000, but it's 1 million gallons. Another person had some ideas that were implemented and our energy usage went down 3.4%. And so those are just two simple examples. We have to leverage all of those ideas.
So I know we're running short on time, but there are a handful of questions that we would love to ask still. One of them is of some interest to people, at least from online and conversations. In preparing for this conversation, you and I spoke about Medicaid expansion as important to Regional Health and Western South Dakota. Last May, we had the privilege of having Carrie Banahan, Executive Director for Connect, Kentucky's highly successful expansion effort with us. She spoke of the benefits to the healthcare providers and the benefits to the residents of the state. Seems pretty simple. Last year, everybody clapped about how simple it was, and we should have that in South Dakota. Why do you think South Dakota has not moved forward with this? And what impact would it have on regional health?
Show of hands, are any politicians in the room? I think there's probably three or four reasons. I think number one, I think there's an overall lack of education about what exactly this bill does. So I'll try to be really simple in the explanation. And you know, Governor Dugard phoned. I've had several conversations with him about this, and I was honest with him, and I said, "You messed this up. You're not explaining this correctly." That every time I've heard him speak, it's been, "This is a Native American issue. This improves healthcare for Native Americans." Yes, that's true. But here's the facts. The way South Dakota's model for expanding Medicaid is organized is 100% of the funding comes from Indian Health Services at the national level. 100% of the funding. So the state would get about $60 or $70 million additional dollars from Indian Health Services national. By getting that money in, instead of, and I'll try to keep it simple, that new money would come in, would give new money to the state, which allows the state to raise the poverty level that is now eligible for Medicaid. And so basically what they did is they took the extra $60 to $70 million and said, okay, how many more people can we insure with this money? And it's about 47,500. Of that 47,500, 15,000 are Native American, and 32,500 are non-Native American. This is not a Native American issue. The funding comes from Indian Health Services, but the beneficiaries are the state of South Dakota. It's the entire state. This is not a Native American issue. This is a state issue. So imagine, as an economy, we now have 47,500 people who now have Medicaid coverage. It's a healthier workforce. They can now have a primary care doctor. They can now access health care properly. They can get preventative services done. Whereas when they were uninsured, their access to health care is an emergency department. And we know that is not the best way to access health care. And so with Medicaid, at least, they now have proper access to health care, and they are a healthier workforce. But only one-third of the recipients are Native American. Two-thirds are non-Native American. This is a benefit to South Dakota, period. It's not Native Americans in South Dakota. It is South Dakota, period. It benefits all of us. I don't know why that is such a hard concept. Now, some would say, so I think it's a lack of education of that model. The second is, I think we have a group of citizens, legislators, whoever it might be, who do not want any more federal government involved in South Dakota. That's a very interesting thing. I grew up on a family farm, a dairy farm in Idaho. We had federal assistance in the milk program when milk prices went all wacky, and they were trying to save the family farm. We all know there is a significant amount of federal monies that go to ranchers and farmers today. So if we want to stand on a bully pulpit and say we want no federal help, then let's talk about that in a serious way. It's interesting that we can say we want it on this side and we don't want it on this side. The way the state legislates, the bill was written, that if the feds change the policy and the funding is no longer coming, then the coverage goes away. So there's a huge safety net that exists that if, in fact, the funding model changes, you can pull the ripcord and you can be done. It's a very interesting, but I think when it gets positioned as a Native American issue, I think there is a portion of the public, whether it's us as citizens or legislators or whatever, who turn off. And that's very unfortunate, but I think that's what's happened. Very different than if it was from the beginning presented as this is a benefit to South Dakota, period.
Thanks, Brent. In a healthy community, What role does the nonprofit sector have? You run the largest employer in Western South Dakota. You're a nonprofit. What role does the nonprofit sector have, and what does it look like in a healthy community?
I think it's a three-legged stool. I think that the not-for-profit is one leg, for-profit is another, and civic is the third. And that includes not only civil government, but also education and many other civil entities. It's a three-legged stool. Each of them play a critical role. I think because of the touch points that not-for-profits have in a community, they are vital to be at the table. Their insights and their ability to affect change from a social perspective is immense, more than most for-profit companies have. The models are just different, but the two fit together. If the economy improves, if education improves, if crime goes down, if homelessness goes down, that benefits all of us, whether we work at Black Hills Power, whether we work in the school district, whether we own a hotel. Whatever we do as an entity, we are benefited by society improving, all of us. And so I think it plays a key role. Sometimes it plays a leadership role in helping to activate these efforts, and sometimes it plays a support role. It depends on what the issue is. But it cannot do it by itself. Civil government can't do it by itself, nor can the for-profit community. It takes all of them working together. And I think that's where I think the next big step for the community, as I see it, is we have got to do that. We've got to make that change. We've got to pull those leaders together in a concerted effort with a bold vision. I mean, imagine if we had a vision within our community that said, by such and such a date, there will be no homelessness. No one will go to bed hungry. All kids will be ready for school when they enter kindergarten. That 100% of our youth will be at the third grade reading level in the third grade. That we'll have no high school dropout. That crime will be the lowest in the country. I mean, just, you know, those are pretty bold statements. But why would we not set bold statements like that and then organize ourselves to say, let's see what we can do to get there? That sounds a lot more exciting than let's get together to see if we can improve it by 1%. You know, we can trip over ourselves and get 1%. That's not a goal. That's not a vision. That's not something that energizes. A goal of saying, let's figure out what we can do as a community to drive another 10,000 jobs within Pennington County or the Black Hills. That's exciting stuff.
Looking toward this future, what will the people in the Black Hills region see at Regional Health that will impact their lives in the next 5 years?
That's a great question. So we're on a pretty significant transformation journey as an organization. And so a couple highlights. Within the healthcare space, when I got here, we had about 10 different computer systems that were used throughout Regional Health. And so you all have experienced this. You didn't know it, but you experienced it. When you go into the cardiologist and they enter all your information, but then you go to the hospital and they have to enter it again. And you go to the doctor, your primary care, and they enter it again. And then you go to the emergency department, they enter it again. Because those are all disparate computer systems. And oftentimes they don't all talk to each other. That means patient safety risk, because the emergency department doesn't know what the cardiologist did and vice versa. And so when I got here, if we in fact aspire to be high quality and a safe environment, we need to have a unified electronic medical record. And so we began that journey. Now, it would have been easy to pick a vendor. The vendor that we implemented at my previous employer in Wisconsin implemented Epic. Mayo Clinic is currently implemented at Epic as the system. Sanford has Epic. Epic is widespread across the United States. I chose not to make that decision, but rather engage caregivers and physicians to evaluate all the options and to come back with a recommendation. We had over 800 caregivers and 80 doctors involved in the evaluation process. 800 caregivers and 80. Why? Because this change is going to be very difficult. Remember, change is tough. Implementing a new computer system is going to be difficult. I wanted lots of people to have fingerprints on it and to own this decision. Their recommendation to the board was to move to Epic. That's what we're doing. So we begin that implementation this fall in moving to a unified record. That's a big one. The other, Custer, I think everyone knows, we're building a new hospital and clinic in Custer. A fantastic partnership with the community. The community actually increased their local sales tax by 0.5%, 0.5 cent, and they will contribute $4 million over the next 11 years to help build that hospital and clinic. By comparison, that would be $60 million in Rapid City. Imagine passing a $60 million sales tax increase over an 11-year period to improve the healthcare system. We couldn't even do it for teachers. That's my point. We as a community have an illness. We have an illness. We are building a new clinic in Sturgis, right adjacent to the hospital, so it's going to be seamless in the care that patients receive and make it easier for our doctors and caregivers. Here in Rapid City is some of our biggest changes. We're building a new patient tower. All rooms will be private rooms. We're expanding the emergency department. We're going to build a musculoskeletal center. If we have enough money, and part of that will be through philanthropy, we're going to redo the women and children's area and have a state-of-the-art women and children's area. We're going to have a medical office building right adjacent to the hospital. So you can imagine, you pull up to see your physician and you need to go to the hospital for tests, you literally don't have to get in your car. You would move from one building down the hallway, receive those tests in the hospital, and you can come back. The goal is to create an integrated healthcare system that envelops the patient in their care. I say to our caregivers and our physicians that when a new caregiver joins us or a patient comes in to see us, we need to treat them like a brand new baby joining a family. Right? We nurture them. We hug them. Right? We envelop them. It is a love. We don't treat them like a thorn bush. And that's the role we have as a healthcare provider. Because as I mentioned, everyone that comes to see us is in need of some kind. And it's a responsibility, it's an opportunity and a responsibility to provide that all-encompassing care. We are recruiting new specialists to come here. So many services currently, if you need those services, you have to leave the area to get that care because we don't have them here. We're expanding our services and the types of specialists that we will have here locally. So you don't have to leave the area to receive complex care. So there's lots of things that are taking place, and I'm very excited about it.
Brent, I want to say thank you again for taking time this morning, but for the conversation and dinner last night and for the time the rest of today. I think it's great to get to hear your thoughts and what the vision is for regional health. It's a huge employer and has enormous impact on our community. Thank you for taking time today. We have a gift from the Susie Kappa Art Center, a piece of local art to share with you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Our April guests will be Kelly Lindquist from ArtSpace out of the Twin Cities. They're a nonprofit developer with about $500 million of assets around the country that focus on community building. He'll be here on April 21st. And we're pleased to announce that Morning Phillip has been invited to Bush Connect in May. And we will be replicating this every aspect of it, the dinner the night before, this public, coffees afterwards, in front of a few hundred people at the Depot in Minnesota. And our guest will be Jennifer Ford Reedy, the president of the Bush Foundation. Thanks for coming, everybody. One more thing, I apologize. So we're going to try, we want to open up the co-working space. You may have seen it in email. So after today, please stay if you want. And April 21st, please stay.